Welcome back to Don't Call It a Book Club. My name is Luke.
My name is Dan.
Today we're all the way through Babel. Officially Babblers, Dan.
Are we?
I think the two of us could say that.
I don't know if at this point I would want to accept that.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. we'll be talking about the entirety of the book. But I hear you've got a little bit of a warm-up for me.
I do have a warm-up, Luke, and this comes in the form of an unresolved question. This is Dan presents a mystery.
Okay.
Luke, when we were growing up, what were the genres that were the big genres of movies? Give me like the top three.
And I'm assuming you're not saying just like general categories. You want like action movie? Are you counting that?
Oh,
as
yeah.
As a genre?
That's one.
Okay. Action movie, kind of like dumb, goofy comedy.
Uh-huh.
I think. And then I'm gonna not say rom-com because I wasn't really watching rom-coms when I was younger. But what's my third?
Luke, we actually don't even need a third because you've already hit on it. What happened to comedy? Because... Since I've been doing an analysis now, since 2015, has there been like a huge blockbuster comedy at the movies that you remember going to see that was like a huge event? Because do you remember how big comedies were when we were growing up? Like, these were the big movies. These were movies that were making tons of money. We're talking like Pineapple Express. We're talking like any Adam Sandler movie that would get... in the theaters. I cannot remember the last time I like heard about a big comedy in the movies that wasn't sort of also like an artistic movie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I feel like most of them now, or at least currently, I'm not gonna say now, I'm gonna say currently, because for some reason there's a difference there to me, are like sequels or big action movies,
right?
But I don't know when the last like actual big blockbuster comedy I went. I feel like the Dungeons and Dragons movie is the last one I can think of, and I don't know if that even really counts.
I don't think it counts. I think it has comedy in it, but it's not a comedy.
Right.
It's an action movie.
Yeah.
And I feel like the way to sort of trace the lineage of this, Luke, and I'm gonna throw something out here, and it might be controversial.
Okay.
I think Kevin Hart killed the genre.
Ooh, interesting. Okay.
And here's why. Because you can sort of trace the big comedy blockbuster lineage with like big comedian actors that have been in them.
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got Will Ferrell. We've got Bill Murray. Like Zach Galifianakis took us into the Hangover era.
Okay. Yeah. He was somewhat more short-lived than the others, but yes.
Yeah, they've been getting shorter over time, and Kevin Hart and Will Ferrell tried to team up and do Get Hard, and it did not work.
Okay, right.
And now I think what's happened is Hollywood has just decided that comedy can fit in to the other movies now. Because now you'll have you'll have like... the Disney Jungle Cruise movie that's got like some jokesters in it, and like they'll just put Jack Black in a movie and be like, see, it's a comedy now.
I see. You're saying we chopped up the comedy genre and squeezed it into the others.
We squished it and molded it and tried to make it fit into the other ones. Cause there, I mean, when was the last like Wedding Crashers or I'm not saying these are good movies. I'm just saying, you remember when these movies were like huge?
Yeah, I do.
What happened? What happened to them? No one is asking these questions. I'm asking, where are these buried? Okay.
Yeah.
What
are
did they do?
Missing them? Like, I feel like they're probably still there and maybe they're just not getting the blockbuster treatment. No.
So, Luke, when I was traveling recently, there was a movie on the plane that was Will Ferrell and Reese Witherspoon doing like a, what was it called? It was called like You're Cordially Invited or something like that. I could tell immediately this movie was trash. This movie, from the poster, I could tell this movie was trash because it was only operating on like the sort of... like star power of these two actors and like nothing. There was nothing there. There was literally nothing there to the movie. And I get that that's how these movies operated for a while. Like, I'm not saying that these comedies didn't operate this way, but I had not heard about this movie until I was on this flight and it showed up on the movies thing.
Sure. Yeah.
The main, I want to really key in on this though, because the main thing that I think we're missing is the movie theater blockbuster comedy experience, because these are definitely coming out on streaming. Like, I saw a movie with Andy Samberg where he was like going through time over and over again. That was like definitely a comedy, came out in the last like 3 or 4 years or something. Mm-hmm. It was pretty good. And Andy Samberg sort of like was that lead comedy guy. But this, I doubt, had a big movie theater premiere.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure not. Okay, actually, so the one thing that I can think of that's come out recently, what does Barbie count?
Okay, this is the one. This is the one that I have been wrestling with. I don't know if it counts in the same way. Do you know what I mean?
I feel like it's maybe because it's more it's like themed or something.
Maybe
like
it feels like it's saying it's too serious. It feels like it's too serious in a way.
Oh, okay, because it is like a like talking about current issues.
Yeah.
It's not just like purely a dumb comedy.
And I want to say, Luke, I recently saw I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, which was Adam Sandler and the Paul Blart guy pretending to be gay to get benefits. Did they talk about gay rights in the movie? Of course they did. Did they do a good job? Absolutely not. And this is sort of my point, is like the movie was more about the movie was not about gay rights. Okay. I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. Yeah. I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry was about how funny it was that these two straight guys were pretending to be gay guys. That was the, if you summarized it, that was sort of it about the movie. Now, yeah, like I said, to give them a little bit of credit, there was like a wholesome message in it that we should probably treat gay people as like human beings, but there were a lot of laughs about how it was kind of weird.
Right. I see. Okay. I see your point. Can I go back to something that you said earlier?
Let's
because
do it.
You said you blamed Kevin Hart for this and then did not elaborate further. Was that purely a reference to Get Hard? Do you actually have a Kevin Hart?
Okay. Here's why I'm blaming Kevin Hart for this. Okay. I feel like Zach Galifianakis had this moment where he was everywhere. Mm-hmm. He capitalized on the moment, had a big blockbuster run of comedies. Obviously, the Hangover movies. He also had Due Date with Robert Downey Jr., which you may or may not remember.
I do recall, yes.
And I think there was another one. And now he's still doing stuff. He's just like not the funny, big, funny, haha comedy guy. Before that, I mean, you can name a bunch of them, right? There's a whole lineage of people who started on SNL and then transitioned into making big blockbuster comedy movies. Now, after Zach, the big comedian that comes into my mind that was in the zeitgeist was Kevin Hart. Mm-hmm. Kevin, where was the big Kevin blockbuster? Because since then, I don't know. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen one.
I'm trying to think. So he was just in a lot of different things, but I feel like he was never the big main character in a big blockbuster.
Right. But it felt like he was always in like I said, Disney's Jungle Cruise, and he was sort of the comic relief in that, or the like Journey to the Center of the Earth. Or maybe I'm thinking of Jack Black for that one. Jack Black does this a lot too, which is why I'm not letting him get away unscathed.
Yeah.
I feel like Jack Black and Kevin Hart did this together in that Jungle Cruise movie with The Rock and like, I don't know who else was in it. Do you you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think so. Wasn't it Jumanji? or something? I don't know.
What did they do to my boy? They cut
so
him
Kevin
up
Hart was in a lot of stuff. Honestly, his first couple stand-ups by Kevin Hart, phenomenal.
We're a team.
I'm getting sidetracked about but
right.
I think I see your point. But yeah, big picture stuff. I don't know. I think that you might be right that comedy has kind of been chopped up and squeezed into other things. I also think there's something here about, as you also mentioned, like more things are going to streaming. But also, do you think there's something about just like, there's not really like, there's no monoculture anymore?
Well, I don't think that's true, Luke, because you can, I saw the 7th Jurassic Park movie yesterday.
Did you? Nice. Okay. How was it?
There were dinosaurs in it, so.
Cool.
So that was cool.
Cool. All right.
Anyway, well, Luke, listeners, if you have an answer, like, was there, was there like a bank that collapsed that had been funding all of these in 2015, or like, was there some government, like, state regulation that came into effect that I don't know about that?
Maybe there was just a shortage of the big, funny, goofy guys.
Luke, there's...
That were up for the task.
I don't buy it. That I don't buy.
Okay. I agree. I agree. But bring them back. Bring my comedy, my dumb comedies back.
I will say, I don't know how much they actually contributed to the culture. I should say that. I don't know if we need another...
Outrageous thing to say.
I don't know if we need another 50 First Dates.
Oh, I forgot about 50 First Dates.
See, you see what I'm saying, though, Luke?
There were Napoleon Dynamite, Dan. We did a whole episode on it.
We did do a whole episode about Napoleon. Yeah. God, okay.
Critical social infrastructure.
That's true.
Maybe this is why we're going downhill.
But okay, whoa, hold on.
2016 was the last.
wait, because we do need to stay on this now that you've introduced Napoleon Dynamite, because I'm wondering now if this has been replaced in our cultural experience. Because, Luke, let me remind you, before memes were big on the internet, the thing you would do with your friends to reference the same thing would be to quote Napoleon Dynamite, or probably quote a funny comedy movie that you'd seen before.
Yeah.
And maybe we just have evolved beyond it now, right? Like, maybe we don't need these kind of dumb comedies because we don't need the office funny guy quoting from a 2-hour film that he had to sit through to write down his funny quotes, his quips he's going to say at the office. He's just on Facebook all day.
Right.
And in between telling you about vaccine misinformation, he's telling you about a funny meme he saw.
This is a good point. I do think that there's been maybe I'm just like aged out of the group that does this, but I feel like there's less quote, like movie quotes being said just socially. My last thing on this, actually, I don't think I do this on the show, but one thing that I occasionally do is I'll like add extra like syllables to names or something.
okay.
And I finally figured out why I started doing that. And it's because I watched an ad for Mr. Deeds, and Winona Ryder in that movie says that she's trying to make up a town name in Iowa, and she says she's from Winchesterton Fieldville. And I like I saw that yesterday and I was like, that's why I say that.
Wow. That would have taken Luke decades of therapy.
There have been times where I'm like, where did I get this dumb thing from where I like just add an extra like traditional syllable to things? I don't know. But that's it.
Oh, that's great. That's a breakthrough, Luke. Congratulations. I
know. Huge moment for me. Wow. Okay.
Wow. We started big picture and we brought it down into the individual and the personal, Luke. And speaking of big picture turning extremely personal, let's talk about Babel.
Yeah. Speaking of comedy, let's talk Babel.
Let's talk about the ending of Babel.
Yeah. Okay. One thing that I realized, okay, let me get back in the zone, because I feel like this is too abrupt of a transition. Okay, serious stuff. We're talking Babel. One thing I realized as I was going through this is that we kind of ended, or at least I said last episode about how like I was glad that Letty had like actually joined the cause. I had like a little bit of a defensive Letty, and I'm very bummed.
Yeah, that was that was Letty's
the worst now. Brutal. Brutal stuff.
Yeah. I don't know, because like, okay, we're going to be doing a lot of like big picture discussion about this book and the message in the book, and like little picture discussion about individual stuff that's happening. Because do you think the big picture message here is that just like you can't be a true ally in this world? Do you know what I mean? Because it doesn't seem like any of the white people here. I don't know if Professor Kraft from the Babel College was white or not. I get the sense that they were, but I
think so. I don't think this is the message, because I think Dr. Kraft was in it. But also all of the like labor unions.
That's people. True. But Luke, the only reason that these people presumably sided with the babblers who were striking was because it was in their interest.
Right.
Like,
yes.
They stood to gain like better protections in their jobs.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
Not just like, oh yeah, you're right, this is bad, we shouldn't do this.
Yeah, I will say there are some times throughout the book where they mention that like the only way that you can force this issue is through like naked self-interest. You can't like appeal to people's morality.
At least this is the perspective that Robin has, yeah. And doesn't seem to be challenged very much.
I think that's the kind of... I think that is a takeaway from the book, which I actually... you're right that we're going to be jumping in and out of like big picture stuff. I actually think that's kind of a weak... Like, I disagree with that a little bit. Like, I think it is a very... I think it's very accurate, like, for society at large, maybe... But I think there are plenty of people that act morally.
I like, and maybe this is Luke and Dan, two white, straight white guys trying to be like, hey, wait, we could be good, right? but also, like, to be fair, you know, in like the American Civil Rights Movement, there were plenty of like young white people in the South who like stood in solidarity with black people protesting and like doing sit-ins and things like that. Like, I don't know if it like always is self-interest. And I guess Professor Kraft gives us an example of like one person out of a, like literally everybody else that's this. And I guess maybe the message here is that it's extremely rare that anybody would act this way. It just feels like the Letty story is so rough for me, because she feels like the person who would be like able to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, okay, let me pause there.
Yeah.
And say something else. I think there's a distinction to be made here between like the empire doing things for like morally good reasons versus self-interested things, and like an individual person.
Okay. Yeah. Definitely.
And I think that the book is correct, is largely correct, that like an empire or a society is gonna do most things based on their like self-interest.
The interest of the people in power. Like the interest of the people who are pulling the levers. Yeah.
Yes. But there are plenty of, I mean, like the book references abolition a lot. There are plenty of like abolitionists that do it purely, they're like arguing purely on moral grounds. Anyway, getting to Letty.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can kind of like, I think it kind of makes sense for Letty's character.
Actually. Yeah.
As I read more, because like she does throughout the book, she doesn't really understand like exactly what they're talking about. And kind of gets like, I don't want to say she gets forced into a situation, but like she was not put into the like rebellious situation of her own free will, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And so I think it kind of makes sense for her to betray them.
Well, I think part of the reason why is it's just a huge bummer that Letty isn't yes. able to like truly love her friends in like a complete way, that it's like,
yeah,
it's just, she wasn't able to do it. And that's just a huge bummer, to read. And I think also it's really sad because, you know, you can sort of see two paths for Letty's character to take. And one of them is the realization that she is being also oppressed by this system of like patriarchy. And she's like a product of this system and like is in potential solidarity with Robin and Victoire and Remy. And they can work together to change how the society works. But instead, she's taken the other route, which is that, like, it's inevitable, and she should just be grateful that she has the opportunity to do this thing.
Right.
And it's just, that was just so sad to read, because she's, like, a smart person. She's somebody who thinks a lot about stuff, and she just came to the conclusion that it was all inevitable and is just going to suffer for the rest of her life because of that. And she doesn't have to, like, she didn't have to do that. She could have believed in a different future. But
yes, I think that's true. I think when you think about the like sequence of events for Letty, is so she basically goes from like not knowing anything about this, which is a criticism, right, because she should have been more aware, they're on this trip and boom, they're covering up a murder. They get home, they're covering up a murder in a really stressful situation. They get discovered, and then they're like they're hideaways, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so she is in a situation where she either has to betray them or be a like hideaway revolutionary. Right.
Right. Right.
And I just like I agree. It sucks that she chose the betrayal route, but I think it makes sense when you consider, like, for her character. I mean,
well, and I think this is like, the more we talk about it, the more I think this is right for her character, because I think it also gets at the insidious aspect of like elevating people into positions of power within these kind of systems, because the Letty who didn't get to go to Babel, I think, would have been fine being like a rebellious hideaway, like the Letty who was going to be forced to marry young and like not get to live up to her potential. That Letty is like, fuck this whole thing sucks, like I want to change this. But
I see, yeah,
the fact that she like was lucky, truly just lucky enough to get elevated to a position of power, like gave her something to want to hold on to. It gave her something that she was like, I can't, like, I don't want to risk this thing that I've been given, this power even that I have, this little bit, for this potential to, like, you know, help my friends or like change the system at large. Such a bummer.
It's a big contrast, now that you say that, between how Letty views this and how like Robin and the others do, right? Where,
right,
as you're saying, I agree with you. I think that because she has been given this opportunity, she is going to be like more grateful and stick with the program. Whereas we hear multiple times from Robin and crew that when they argue with like the professors and stuff about their decisions, the big thing is they're like, I realize that I have been given a lot, but I don't think that I have to feel grateful. I think that I can still like recognize that despite me personally being privileged, I'm willing to throw it away because like this is about like society at large. So I think there's a big interesting contrast between the two situations.
Right. Right. Well, and I think it's interesting too, because Letty experiences real prejudice every day, like people trying to look down her shirt, people not like listening to her when she argues. Like, she experiences a lot of the things that, not the same things, but like the, she experiences real prejudice, like Remy, like Robin, like Victoire, obviously different, but she just like still internalizes the like being grateful. I'm trying to figure out what makes it different. Like, why does she still internalize that she should be grateful, even though like she's not being treated like an equal? Like, do you think she has internalized misogyny in the sense that she doesn't, like, she does truly feel like it's a gift that she's not actually worth this thing? It doesn't feel that way to me.
It doesn't feel that way to me either. I think to some degree there's a level of like belonging for her that is absent in the others, because like, yes, sure. She is like a like doesn't have the same, like she's definitely not equal, right? But she belongs there.
That's true. I guess that is her
England,
country,
I should say.
Yeah.
So I think that's a big part of it. Yeah,
I think you're right too. I also think she has a sort of a different mindset about like the way that she talks about it. It feels a lot like survival of the fittest. It feels a lot like she's like, okay, this is the environment I'm in. I am going to do whatever I can to like be like surviving in this environment. Like, she talks about how she has to be strong. Like, academics like will put up with a lot, but weakness isn't one of them, which as an academic I'm like, oh yes, of course, we don't tolerate any weakness, we're all very strong powerful people. Which is like, come on, Letty, that's not how it works.
Right, it's not how academia in general necessarily works. I can see her being like a female in academia, that being a thing.
Yeah, sure. But it seems like she has more of like a survival of the fittest mentality, sort of like, these are just my circumstances and I'm going to do whatever I can to get through it.
Yeah. Yeah. She's an interesting character, honestly.
Yeah. Oh, man. Okay. Little thing here. Can we just stop living in Oxford, guys? I get that it's convenient. Okay. But like, maybe go out just a couple miles away from the middle of town.
You mean are you talking about like the library that they occupy?
Every single thing that they do, where they're like, first off, they're occupying a library that's just in Oxford, where everybody's looking for you.
Right.
Don't do that.
Sure.
Don't do that.
You've got a little, some kind of thing though going on.
Yeah. Okay. Look how well that works.
It seems very flimsy, where they're like, yeah, but some people think it belongs to these people. Some people belongs to these other people. So no one ever like comes in here. And like, I agree. That sounds very flimsy.
And the glamour that they talk about, they're like, oh yeah, this stops all sound from getting out. And then at one point, Griffin's like, oh yeah, it only works. It intermittently doesn't work. And it's like, okay, so how safe really are we, guys?
Right, right.
Go dig a hole, make a little hobbit hole, 2 miles out of town.
Right. You're telling me there's not some like kids exploring that they're like, let's go in this old library or something.
This is what I was thinking the whole time they're there, is I'm like, I, as a kid, would have totally gone in there and been like, whoa, what's up?
Yeah. It's a risk.
So,
but they want to be nearby, Dan. It's a magical place. Okay. You can't get away from it.
I guess you can't get away from it. That's true. Because then they also, they imprison Robin and Victoire there as well.
In like Oxford Tower or like castle or something, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get them out of there. What are you doing?
That one's like an overnight though, right?
I guess, but like there's a train to London that takes an hour.
Okay, sure.
Send them to London. You have people that you think are dangerous and you're just like leaving them in their home turf. Because what happens after they get out? Immediately they go underground.
Yeah. It's a cool place though, Dan. Listen, you gotta go.
It does sound cool. I'll admit that.
I have another somewhat small thing that's pretty early on. So when they're at the library, their old library before the betrayal, they're trying to come up with plans to stop the vote or
Stop the Steal, as we would say.
Right. And one of the big ones, they're like, we need to basically a combination of influence public opinion, but also influence like the politicians that are going to ultimately vote.
Yeah.
And I will say, you guys are not immune from hubris, because like you were talking about a group of non-native people who have only ever lived in like a very cloistered elite institution, and it's like you have literally no clue how the general public of England thinks in any way. Like you have no idea what people are
right thinking. Right, but they think they do because they've read a lot of books, and so they're writing this stuff. Like, they're putting together, like, a Shakespearean monologue that they're like, oh, the people are going to love this shit. And people are getting this pamphlet, and they're like, I don't know what any of this means.
Yeah, I don't know. I appreciate that you're trying, but you gotta recognize you're not, like, influencing public opinion for an important vote is very difficult. Like, that's what people's entire political careers are about.
Yes. Now, to their credit, the leader of the laborers who works with them, they talk about how they gave them a bunch of pamphlets and they sort of translated it to get the word out, like, to their people. So, like, I agree. I would have thought that the Hermes Society would have realized their strengths and weaknesses a long time ago.
Well, so I think that I I know that you hate Griffin.
Well, kind of, yeah.
But I think in this section, Griffin gets proven correct a lot, because Griffin is like the only thing that we can do in this situation is like violence, basically. That's the only way we can influence it.
I mean, you can't really prove a negative, so you can't prove what would have happened if they had taken a different route. However, it does seem like the book is agreeing. It does seem like the book is like, well, and even, I don't know if the book in the end is agreeing, because I don't know if the civilization ever capitulates. Like, I don't know if Britain ever says like, oh yeah, we should change because this violence had an impact, or if they're just like, well, glad we've defeated those terrorists, back to what we were doing.
Right. Okay. Yes. It doesn't say whether it has an impact. I have a point later that maybe we should talk about this, because I think there's a discussion to be had about what the, like, some of the main messages of the books are. I will say the title of the book is Babel or the Necessity of Violence.
Yes.
that's the title of it. So
sure.
I do think that the book is kind of on Griffin's side.
Probably.
Anyway. Okay.
So, Luke, the last bit of this book escalates quite a lot.
Yeah.
And in that escalation, a part of it is we see how powerful these bars are.
Mm-hmm.
Were you like, finally, we're doing some cool shit with the bars?
Well, what are the examples that you're thinking of?
Griffin's whole, like, Batman, like tool belt where he's pulling out bars to do all kinds of useful shit. And I'm like, thank you.
Yes. Yes.
Where he's like, this bar is a stun grenade. Boom. Stun grenade. This bar makes me invisible. Boom. Invisible. It's like, yes. Thank you. Practical bars doing shit.
I do think, like, Griffin comes out a lot in this section fairly positively, because it's clear that everyone else is, like, as we discussed last episode, is more on the academic side of things. And he's very much like a practical research guy,
right?
Or like an applied research kind of guy, and knows how to use these in like real world scenarios.
Right. Like, this guy is claiming, and I'll bet probably capable of blowing up a whole ship building warehouse.
Yes. Which is what he goes to do. Right.
Right. Like, you all need to be taking lessons from this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I think as we like this is kind of or similar to what we talked about last episode, which is they try to get, I think, generally too creative and clever with the silver bars and stuff like that. And they don't really think about just like, how am I going to achieve my goals with this?
Right. Right. Hmm. They're doing research for research's sake. You got to do research for a public good.
Right. Right. I have a somewhat related note.
Yeah.
I have a thing here where our author, who is definitely an academic person.
Oh yeah.
I think demonstrates some I don't know, academic bias. In the part about this, I'm jumping us ahead a little bit to where they've kind of already occupied the tower.
Yeah.
And so everything's falling apart, and she kind of makes a note of how, like, sure, there's other people in the country that are like capable of maintaining stuff, but they're like, they were some like undergrads who never really got like cool fellowships.
Right. The Cambridge dig.
Yeah. There's and like, I have to say, as a person with a PhD in a like engineering field.
Yeah.
The people with like terminal bachelors or masters in these kinds of fields are better than the academics at like maintaining or like maintenance and engineering. And so like the idea that bridges and streets are being maintained by the academics and not the like people that have been gone out there to get a job is kind of crazy to me.
Right. Right. Not the like lab techs is ridiculous.
Right.
Especially considering how lucrative this is. Like, you're telling me they're not training a bunch of people to be able to maintain them so they don't have to like travel to London to do this. They're like, truly, it sounds like a dozen people in the whole country.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, okay. So there's a thing about like how the Babel scholars are the ones that are the best at maintaining everything.
Yes.
And it's like, absolutely not. I fully agree that the Babel scholars are the best maybe at like coming up with new
match pairs. Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. But the like maintenance tech in London.
Yeah.
Who got his undergrad degree at Babel and has been working on maintenance as a job for the last 10 years.
Right.
So much better. So much better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's like, oh, no. I know the trick for this one. You actually take the etching pen, the one they give you, you have to modify it a little bit so it'll really work right. And then you spit on it a little bit, you give it a little shine, and then it works no problem. Meanwhile, the professor's like, we got to take this back to the lab. I got to run some tests on it. And it's like, that's going to take months. Give it to the tech.
Exactly.
The system's broken, Luke. You're telling me the system is broken?
Well, that's just my thing about the people in academia are not necessarily the best at everything.
Wow. Wow.
Shots fired.
Very humble. This is very humble of you, Dr. Luke. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't go so far as to say that.
Right. Well, you are the best at everything, to be fair.
They did give me a degree saying so.
Mm-hmm. I see it on your wall right there. Best at everything.
Yeah, I carry it around with me, actually. Okay. One thing that these people are not the best at, though, is planning. Long-term planning.
Okay.
Robin and Victoire show up. They're not bringing any snacks to the tower?
Okay. Yes. I have some notes about the planning going on.
Okay. Because I get that it's, like, sort of rushed. But even if it's rushed, you've got to have, like, the basics where you're, like, food, water, those are the main two. And then anything else is sort of extra if you're being really bare bones about it. And you can get the water check off.
Yeah.
But like food's a little non-negotiable, fam.
Yeah. I was trying to explain this away by them just like thinking that they weren't going to succeed.
Okay.
But, and so they were just like, yeah, we only need food for like 2 days because we're going to fail or something. But yeah, you gotta, I don't know.
A couple of snacks, at least.
At least think about what's gonna happen.
Right.
You know. But this is also kind of similar to what we talked about last episode about when they don't really make a good plan about how to get away with their little murder. They also kind of like, right. I was losing my mind when they're in the tower. They've occupied it. And yeah. they're like, don't really have a plan for their demands. Yeah.
They're kind of just sitting like, there.
And at the very end, I'm gonna give you some kudos because you did call the method of sabotage pretty early on. Mm-hmm. But they like get to this point and they're like shocked. They're like, this is a crazy proposal that you're putting forth, Robin. That we're gonna sabotage the tower. That's insane.
Yeah.
It's like clearly this is where we were gonna end up from the beginning. Did you guys not? What did you think we were gonna? What was the point of this? Did you not think that, like, ultimately, if they don't give in, we will either have to blow up the tower or we will give in?
Right.
I feel like that's going in. You know that's the end game.
I think Robin knew it was the end game. I think everyone else was sort of okay with that not being the end game. Like, I think everyone else was in their heart of hearts okay with giving up at a certain point.
Okay, I think I agree with that, but the thing that's crazy to me is that they never talked about it. It seems like they're just taking it one day at a time, and they're never like, all right, if let's say, okay, because they're talking about the bridge falling down, right? That's one big sticking point. They're not like, okay, once the bridge falls down, hopefully they will give in to our demands and whatever, whatever. But if not, what happens next? They don't do that, which is crazy to me.
I
feel like I'm working through every scenario, right? Because it's like kind of boring there.
Oh, yeah. I think that would be the biggest thing that would be encouraging my work is the boredom. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, one, I'm coming up with amazing match pairs. Stress combined with the dire need to solve problems, I am going crazy with it. But also, I think everyone expects them to give in except Robin.
Mm.
Like, I feel like everybody in the tower is like, surely they're not going to let the bridge collapse. Like, surely not. That would be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Robin is the one sort of pushing them all to like go fast because they need to get to the point that I think Robin knew they were going to get to all along.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anyone else believed him until they were actually there. And it was like, oh, shit, we actually do have to do this. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I think it's crazy to not have talked about it more.
Right. Like
every meal.
I can imagine Robin not being the one to bring it up, but they're all sitting together getting some porridge, and then one of them, maybe like, I don't know, Professor Kraft, is just like, hey, so just crazy thought here. What if they don't give up after the bridge collapses?
Yeah.
And Robin just sitting there like quiet, but like big eyes, like looking around at everybody like, well, what do you guys think? That'd be crazy, right? But what if?
Right.
Well, you guys have any thoughts on that? I'm just curious. I haven't thought about it myself, but what do you guys think about it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do agree with you throughout this section. Robin's really the only one that like has, I mean, I like Victoire, I guess also, but not quite to the same level as Robin.
Are
the only ones that have the like seem to have the full conviction for what they're doing.
Right. Right. Okay. I have like one other thing about the plot, and then I have big picture stuff after that. So I get that none of these people are professional negotiators here,
mm-hmm.
but as soon as you know the bridge is going to fail, can you use that as leverage? Like, can you communicate that and be like, hey, it won't fall if you like meet our demands and then we'll open it back up? Do you think that they did that? Because I don't know if they are like explicitly communicating what they know is going to happen or if they're just letting it happen.
They definitely said that they told people that the bridge was going to collapse.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Now, here's
what I don't know if they connected that to be like the bridge is going to collapse in 7 days if you do X, we will do Y. I don't know if that ever happened.
Right. But I just want to make it clear that they're like communicating the consequences of what they're going to do if their demands are not met. So like, it feels like they didn't actually, do you think they actually needed to destroy Babel? Or do you think they just needed to threaten it in like a real way? Do you know what I mean? Like if Robin was like, hey, look, we're going to destroy all the silver you have in here and collapse the tower. Here's how I'm going to do it. Unless you meet our demands. Like, do you think, because Victoire and Robin have this conversation throughout this section, that's like, are you doing this because you're trying to get revenge, or are you doing this because you're trying to change the system? And it's unclear what Robin is actually doing. Like, it sort of mirrors what happens with his dad, where it's unclear if he's acting out of self-defense, if it was an accident, if he was intending it. And it feels to me like this is your like trump card. This is the one that you play when you're like, okay, none of that worked, but like, look, I will destroy it all unless you capitulate now.
Right. I it's never said, but I do think Robin gets to a point where he realizes that he just needs to destroy it, and the like, if they capitulate, it's not quite as good as destroying it, because and again, this is never said, but like, if they get the thing where they're like, okay, we voted to not go to war with China right now, because that's the main demand, right, like, and then they, you know, release it and whatever, they could just vote again, right?
This is what I was thinking the whole time, actually, is like, none of these legal agreements they're asking for are like really binding in any meaningful way.
I mean, if they say like, we also want amnesty, it's like, okay, but like, we're good. I mean, that's not gonna work, right?
We'll tell you what you want to hear to get you out of that tower, but then as soon as you're out, we're gonna just do whatever we want.
I'm not gonna also, just like, you're not, you have become a terrorist, right? Like,
right,
you can't just go back to normal after that,
right? Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess like, ah, man, do you think Robin knew from the beginning, like when they entered the tower, that was what was going to have to happen? Do you think he thought that was the end result?
I feel like probably subconsciously.
Yeah. Because I think you're right. I don't think you can actually use it as a bargaining chip, because I don't think it, like, I think either they just hold another vote, they do another shenanigans to get the war to happen anyway. Like, it doesn't actually change anything. And I wonder if, like, Robin went in knowing that was going to happen, and also knowing that he could not destroy the tower on his own, that he needed to recruit other people to help him with it.
This is an interesting question. I would say no. If this was like Griffin, I would say yes.
Yeah.
But I don't think that Robin would have been capable of like that kind of, I don't know.
Yeah,
sneakiness.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Oh boy.
Anyway,
interesting stuff going on here. You want to talk like big picture slash kind of reviews? Is how I'm thinking of we talk about this.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk big picture.
Yeah, let's talk big picture. I'm gonna kind of mix this with like a review type thing as well.
Yeah.
I really liked the book, I think. I, like, was very interested for most of it. I think it was interesting because, like, it was a fantasy book in the sense that there was magic, right? The silver bars and stuff like that. But that was almost, like, secondary, or not necessarily secondary, but, like, not the main part of the story, right? The main part of the story was their society, colonialism, and then like the individual characters and their interactions amongst themselves. And I do kind of think that the like the magic part kind of came in when it was how do I want to say this? The magic part felt like a little bit of an afterthought, which is fine, I'm realizing.
Yeah.
Like, as I was thinking, as I was reading the book, I was like, the magic, like, the concept of the magic is cool, but doesn't seem to have been quite worked out as much. And as I got to the end, I realized that I was, like, fine with that.
Right. Right.
Because overall, I really liked, I really liked the, I don't know, everything that happened, I guess. What do you have before we start talking beyond our just shallow reviews?
Yeah, I think the magic felt a lot more sort of like metaphor. Like, it was just creating a like literal representation of colonialism, like trying to create more of a literal representation of colonialism, and using this like magic as a nice, neat sort of container for it, like a. Sometimes I struggled to like make the connection. Like, sometimes I felt like the metaphor was being stretched a little bit far, whereas like,
yeah,
like the centralization of power in that key way, it felt like I was having a hard time seeing the parallel in like real society with the metaphor that was being used. That being said, like, I did enjoy it. Like, I felt like it was, I felt like it was effective. Like, I still felt like that tool was effective in explaining sort of what the author was trying to say about colonialism and power and things like that. I, at the end of the book, like, I'm going to explain what I mean in a second, but I started to get some like Ender's Game vibes from it.
Okay.
And what I mean is, some people describe Ender's Game as like bully revenge porn, where it seems like Orson Scott Card wrote a book that was like, he got bullied and decided to write a book that was like, the nerd totally gets one over on his bullies and everybody loves him because he's the most special boy. And I'm not saying, obviously Orson Scott Card has its own fucked up shit to deal with. I'm not saying that that's what's going on here, but I did get a little bit of a sense of it. Like, it sort of feels like revenge, like a revenge narrative from, like the author almost, like coming in and like Robin sort of wins at the end. Like, he doesn't win because he dies, but like, he irreparably damages this colonial empire in a way that like, they're probably not going to be able to continue their mission of colonialism in the same way. And
yeah.
And so in that way, he kind of like wins. It's kind of this story of like one person that defeats the whole British Empire. And I didn't dislike that, but all I'm saying is it sort of reminded me of the Ender's Game, sort of like one smart guy doing something that sort of feels a little bit impossible. And this is also why I feel like it starts to stretch the metaphor a little bit of like, the power in a colonial empire doesn't feel centralized in that way. Like, it doesn't feel like one like person.
This kind of win is not attainable.
Right. Like, it doesn't feel like you can blow up the Death Star and defeat the Empire in this way.
Yes. Yeah. I agree with you with the point that this is kind of where I think the metaphor gets stretched a little bit too far. I've seen, I think in general, the like consensus around this book has been like fairly, like quite positive. The critiques that I've seen has been people are like saying that it's a little bit heavy-handed on just like colonialism is bad, which like to some, which I like kind of disagree with, because I think people think that that's the main point of the book, and I think it's not. I think there's two main points of the book in my mind, and number one is kind of addressing what you've said and what we talked about earlier, which I think that the author is making the argument that violence is necessary.
I agree with you. Yeah.
I think that's the main point of the book. I don't think it's just trying to say colonialism is bad. I think it's trying to say that to achieve goals in like this colonialism setting, violence is critical.
Luke, I also don't think it's, this book doesn't feel like the author is trying to talk back in the past, of course. It feels like the author is trying to talk to people in 2024. And I don't know, like, I think it's very interesting that the author here seems to be making this statement about violence against, like, an oppressive, racist government as yes. being necessary. This book feels very inflammatory in a, like, in our modern sense. Like, it feels very inflammatory for our current moment.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I will say it was written in, like, 2021 or 2022 or something like that.
Sure.
But I agree that it feels very relevant for, like, right now. U.S. Right.
Correct.
And, you know, you can agree or disagree with the point that violence is necessary. But I think I do think that the author is making that argument. It's at least about the past. Now, I know we're saying that it could be said about the present as well. But let me say what the other part of the book, main point of the book, I think.
Yeah.
Is, because yeah. I've also seen, so R.F. Kuang is, she's from China, but moved to the U.S. very young mm-hmm. and went to elite universities.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she went to Oxford, and I think she's doing her, like, a PhD at Yale, right? And so
yeah.
I think that one thing that people say is that, like, you are a privileged person to make this argument. But here's where I think the other main part of the book is, and I think it's more yeah. like a personal thing, because we see over and over again,
yeah,
Robin and the others say that even though they have received, like, these opportunities and they are privileged, they still are capable of, like, strongly critiquing things, and they don't have to feel gratitude, right?
Right.
And so right. I think that, to me, this read, after I read R.F. Kuang's background, this read a little bit personal of a, like, statement from her. So I thought that was, like, another big part of the book that was a little bit under the radar.
I can't, like, I feel like if you're criticizing R.F. Kuang for, like, being a privileged person to write this kind of a book, you didn't read the book. Like, it feels like that message is so clear in the book that, like, yeah. you just didn't read it. Like, you read a different book. Like, you read The Great Gatsby or something instead. because, like, exactly. The whole time our main characters are like, listen, you're missing the point. I don't have to be forever indebted
right.
to this institution. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, knowing her background, that makes a lot of sense. That does feel like a very personal. I mean, I did read the foreword at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and she does talk a lot about how much she loves Oxford as a place. And I think that really comes out in the first third of the book, where, like, they sort of do have this magical school experience that I think academics all have, or at least a yeah. lot of us have, where, like, we go to college or, like, we go to school for the first time, like, either away or, like, to a different school, somewhere where we're, like, challenged and there are peers who are also doing the same kind of work. And it's sort of a magical experience. It's sort of an experience where we're like, oh, this is awesome. This is really good. Yeah. And I think that the first third of this book captures that really well, the experience of, like, growing up and, like in a school that you're really, like, thriving in, mm-hmm. with, like, friends. And, like, I think it's just, like, clearly she has had that experience. And, like, it felt personal. Like, this whole book felt very personal to me.
Yeah. In a way that I think was successful.
Yeah, totally agree. Reviews, Luke, do we have any longer reviews? Did you have anything else you wanted to say review wise?
I think that was kind of my review.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I liked it. I liked the book a lot. I should say, like, obviously the messaging in the book was good. I thought the characters were all very good.
I did too, actually. I, I thought they were like interesting and fairly complex. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the fact that I still do not like Griffin at the end of this. I think he's a horrible person. He's still in my top 10 worst people of all time.
Wait, all time?
Okay, no,
book?
Not of all time, but in the book. okay. I think that that is to the author's credit. Like, I think that these characters were really nuanced and complex. I like that Victoire at the end was like, I don't want to die. Like, I want to leave. I want to go live a life. And so I loved it. I thought that the characters were really good as well. So good work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good work. Tough to see Babel go.
Whew. Yeah, tough one.
Okay, but we can wrap it up there, and announce the next book. Well, actually, first we're traveling once again next week, so you'll miss us for 1 week, but 1 week only.
Watch the Murderbot. Finish the Murderbot series while we're gone.
There you go. That can be what you do. But then when we come back, we are going to be starting Kings of the Wild by Nicholas Eames. So first third of that book.
Mm-hmm.
For 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now, first third. We'll bring the hot takes.